This is a reading of the autobiography of Rudolf Steiner entitled Chapters in the Course of My Life, 1861 to 1907. This is the last section of the reading of the book, chapters 68 through 70. Chapter 68. Strictly speaking, an arrangement established within the Anthroposophical Society, and originally intended to have no connection with the public, does not belong within the framework of this account. Nevertheless, I will describe it, because this too has caused attacks against me. Some years after Marie von Sievers and I became active in the Theosophical Society, we were invited to lead a society like those still in existence, that preserve the ancient wisdom in symbols and religious ceremonies. I had no intention at all to work in the way of such a society. All that anthroposophy represents must arise from its own source of knowledge and truth. There could not be the slightest deviation from this goal. But I have always respected what has arisen in the course of history. It reveals the spirit living in human evolution. Consequently, I favored linking, whenever possible, the new with the historical. And so I accepted the certificate offered me by the society referred to, which belonged to the stream represented by Yarker. It took the form of Freemasonry of the high degree. I took over nothing, absolutely nothing, from the society, except the merely formal right to establish in historical succession my own symbolic ritual activity. Historically, all of this activity was completely independent of any tradition whatever. Although I possessed the formal certificate, nothing was cultivated that did not provide a picture of anthroposophic knowledge. This was intended to accommodate a need that arose among the members. In addition to developing the ideas that clothed spiritual knowledge, there was a need for something that spoke directly to the heart and mind. I wanted to meet those needs. If that society had not made the offer, I would have instituted a symbolic ritual with no historic connection. But this was not intended to create a secret society. It was made very clear to those who wished to participate that they were not joining an order, but that they would experience, as participants in a ceremony, a kind of illustration or demonstration of spiritual knowledge. It was not a ceremony of an order, even though some of it assumed a form similar to the ceremonies of existing orders when their members were accepted or promoted to higher grades. It was a visual, pictorial demonstration of the path a human soul follows when ascending spiritually. There was no question of performing or transmitting anything as existing orders were doing. This is shown by the fact that members of many different orders participated in the ceremonial activities I arranged, and they found aspects that were completely different from anything in their orders. Once a person who participated in our activity for the first time came to see me immediately afterward. He had reached a high rank within an order, but his experience of what had just occurred made him want to hand over to me his insignia of that order. He felt that since he had now experienced true spiritual meaning, he could no longer participate in something stuck in mere formality. I set it right. Anthroposophy may not tear people from their life connections. Rather, it should add something to those connections, not take away from them. So he remained with his order and continued to participate in our symbolic ceremonies. It is certainly understandable that misunderstandings arise when arrangements such as those described above become known, as those described become known publicly. There are many to whom the external fact of being associated with something is more important than any meaning they gain. And so many of the participants themselves spoke about this matter as though they belonged to an order. They were unable to discriminate that what we demonstrated was free of any connection to an order, and that otherwise it would be given only within an order. The fact is that, in this sphere as well, we broke with old traditions. Everything was done as it must be when investigating spiritual reality in an original way, as required for a fully conscious soul experience. Marie von Sievers and I signed certain certificates when, for the sake of historic continuity, we joined the Yarker Institution. The fact that those certificates later became the source of all sorts of slander indicates that people had to treat the ludicrous with earnest scowls in order to create slander. we gave our signatures as a formality. The usual practice was maintained. As we signed, I made a point of saying clearly that it was a mere formality, and that what I wanted to establish would retain nothing from the Yarker arrangement. Of course, it is easy later on to observe that it would have been more intelligent not to have connected at all with something that provided opportunities for later slander. But I may say in all modesty that during that period of my life, I was still one of those who assume uprightness rather than crookedness in those with whom they deal. Spiritual perception did not in the least alter that faith in human beings. Spiritual perception should not be misused to investigate the inner intentions of other people unless they themselves request it. Otherwise, to investigate the inner life of others is forbidden to a spiritual investigator, just as opening a letter without authorization is forbidden. Thus one's relation to others is the same as for those who have no spiritual cognition. There is a difference, though. Either one must assume people to be honorable until proven otherwise, or one must distrust the whole world, in which case it becomes impossible to work socially with others, because this must be built on a foundation of mutual trust, not on mistrust. Within the Anthroposophical Society, the instituted ritual symbolism, having spiritual meaning, proved greatly beneficial to many members. As in every other sphere of anthroposophic work, in this area everything was excluded that did not fit into the framework of full consciousness. There was no question of using unjustified magic, suggestive influences, and so on. Members received something that spoke to their ideation, yet in a way that their power of feeling could also penetrate the meaning with direct perception. And this helped many toward a deeper understanding. The possibility of continuing this activity ceased when the war began. Although there was nothing, certainly nothing like a secret society, it was assumed to be one. And so this symbolic ritual section within the Anthroposophic movement closed in the middle of 1914. The fact is that people who had participated in it became slanderous accusers of that section, to which no one who considered the matter with goodwill and a sense of truth could object. This is an example of the strange human behavior that can arise when people who are not inwardly sincere enter a movement that has genuine spiritual meaning. Such people expect something to satisfy their trivial soul life, and when they naturally do not find that, they turn against the very thing they had looked for in the first place, although with unconscious insincerity. A society like that belonging to Anthroposophy could be formed only from the soul needs of its members. An abstract program that declares this or that action be taken in the Anthroposophical Society could not be instituted. Instead, it has to work with reality. But the reality is simply the soul needs of its members. Anthroposophy is the content of life, was formed from its own sources. It stepped before the contemporary world as a spiritual creation. Many who were inwardly drawn to Anthroposophy sought to work with others. Thus the society was configured by people, some who wanted a more religious character, others something more scientific, and still others an artistic element, and it had to be able to be what was sought. Because the work was based on real soul needs of its members, the private material must be assessed on a very different basis than what was entirely public to begin with. The private material was intended to be given orally, not printed, and what was spoken of came from listening to the members' soul needs as they arose in the course of time. The substance of the public writings corresponds to the demands of Anthroposophy as such, whereas the soul configuration of the whole society, as indicated, played a part in the way the privately printed material came into existence. The end of Chapter 68. Chapter 69. Anthroposophic knowledge was conveyed to the society in a form that can in part be seen from the privately printed material. Meanwhile, Marie von Sievers and I, through our joint efforts, developed more specifically the artistic element, which indeed was destined to become an enlivening power within the Anthroposophic movement. There was recitation oriented toward the art of drama, which had to be cultivated so that the Anthroposophic movement could receive the right content. Also, during my journeys in the service of Anthroposophy, I was able to study the development of architecture, sculpture, and painting. In this description of my life, I have often spoken of the importance of art to one who consciously experiences the spiritual world. Previously, and as I began my anthroposophic work, most of my opportunities involved studying only the reproductions of art created in the course of human evolution. My only access to the original works of art had been in Vienna, Berlin, and a few places within Germany. But now, because Marie von Sievers and I had to travel in connection with anthroposophic work, the treasures and museums all over Europe came within my reach. Consequently, from the beginning of the century, in the fifth decade of my life, I went through a higher training in art, and related to that my perception of the spiritual development of humanity. Marie von Sievers was always my helpful companion. With her fine and tasteful participation in all I was privileged to experience in the realm of culture and art, she shared in and supplemented those experiences in a very beautiful way. She understood how all these artistic experiences flow into anthroposophy to enliven and mobilize its ideas and concepts. The impressions I received through art permeated what I effected in lectures. The practice of viewing the great masterpieces presented our souls with a world from which yet another soul configuration speaks to the present age across time. We could immerse our souls in the spiritual nature of art that still speaks from Cimabue, sorry, I don't know how to pronounce that, Cimabue. Through art, we could go deeply into the fierce spiritual battle of Thomas Aquinas against Arabism at the height of Scholasticism. Being able to observe the development of architecture was especially significant to me. While contemplating the forms of styles, seeds for the forms in the Goetheanum began to grow in my soul. I believe that I have reason to show special gratitude to a destiny that allowed me to stand in Milan during my mature years for the first time and see Leonardo's Last Supper. I was also able to see the works of Raphael and Michelangelo in Rome, and to discuss those experiences with Marie von Sievers. If I were to describe, even briefly, all of those experiences, the book I would have to write would not be small. One is led deeply into the secrets of human evolution when contemplating with the background of spiritual insight such works as the, quote, titled School of Athens or the title Disputa. And if one follows the advance in art from Cimabue through Giotto to Raphael, one sees an ancient vision of spirit gradually fading to be replaced by modern naturalism. This principle of human evolution, which I knew through spiritual perception, manifests clearly in the development of art. It was always very satisfying to me whenever I saw how the anthroposophic movement was given new life through its constant permeation with art. Flexible thinking is needed to comprehend spirit being in ideas and express this through thought. Such mobility comes from filling the soul with art. Furthermore, the society had to be protected from an invasion of inner untruths related to false sentimentality. There is always the danger of such invasion in a spiritual movement. But the inner untruthfulness of sentimentality is cast from listeners when a lecture is enlivened by mobile ideas gained through living in the artistic element. Although sustained by sentiment and feeling, when absolute clarity is sought in the pursuit of art, it can be the most effective balance to false sentimentality. In this sense, I feel that the anthroposophic movement is particularly fortunate that Marie von Sievers was destined to become my collaborator. Her very disposition gave her the knowledge to cultivate with full understanding this element of art, sustained by feeling, yet unsentimental. This inwardly untruthful sentimentality had to be countered continually. It penetrates a spiritual movement again and again. One cannot simply dismiss or ignore it. The very people who are the first to encounter this difficulty are often spiritual seekers in the depth of their souls. At first, however, it is difficult for them to gain a firm relationship to knowledge of the spirit world. Unconsciously, they seek a kind of numbness in sentimentality. They wish for an especially esoteric knowledge. Such knowledge leads them to urge to form exclusive sectarian groups. it is important to make truth the sole directing force of the whole society. Thus those who deviate in one direction or another would always see the example of those who rightfully consider themselves the central bearers of the movement, since they, after all, initiated the movement. Marie von Sievers and I considered it essential to work in a positive way for anthroposophy rather than to fight deviations. Nevertheless, instances did occur, of course, when opposition became necessary. For me, the period before my course of lectures in Paris was most of all a time when an inner process of development formed a unity of soul. I held those lectures during the 1906 Theosophical Congress. Some who attended the conference had stated their desire to hear the lectures in addition to what had been arranged. In Paris, Marie von Sievers and I met Edward Charest for the first time. She had translated his works and corresponded with him for some time. Charest was one of those who attended the lectures. I also had the frequent pleasure of seeing Merezhkovsky, Minsky, and other Russian writers in the audience. During that lecture course, I presented the central spiritual insights into the human being that I felt had matured in me. This feeling that knowledge is mature is essential in spiritual research. Before this feeling can come about, one must experience spiritual perception as it arises in the soul. Initially, the perception is experienced in dim, undefined contours. It must be allowed to sink back into the depths of the soul to mature. Consciousness has not progressed far enough to comprehend the spirit in what one perceives. The deeper area of the soul must join this content, undisturbed by consciousness, in the spiritual world, in the spirit world. In conventional science, a factor of knowledge is not asserted until all necessary observations and experiments have been completed and the relevant calculations proven absolutely correct. In the science of spirit, methodical conscientiousness and discipline are not in any way less necessary. Somewhat different paths are followed, however. Consciousness must be tested in relationship to discerning truth. One must be able to patiently wait with perseverance and inner conscientiousness until that consciousness has passed the test. Its capacity for ideation within a certain realm must become strong enough to bring such spiritual perception to comprehension. In the Paris lecture series, I presented the meaning of a spiritual perception that had gradually matured over a long period of time within me. I explained the general relationship among the aspects of the human being, the physical and etheric organizations as the media for manifesting life, the astral body as the medium for manifesting feeling and volition, and the vehicle of the I, capital. Then I added that the etheric body of a man is feminine and that a woman's etheric body is masculine. Thus anthroposophy illuminated a fundamental question of existence that was often discussed at the time. One need only call to mind the book titled Gender and Character by the unfortunate Weininger for the poetry of that period. The problem was consequently revealed to be part of the deepest aspect of the human being. The human physical body is introduced very differently into the forces of the cosmos than the human etheric body. In the physical body, human beings exist within Earth's forces. In the etheric body, they are linked with the forces of the supra-earthly cosmos. The masculine and feminine aspects lead to the cosmic mysteries. This knowledge was one of my most heart-stirring soul experiences. Again and again it made me aware of how to approach a spiritual perception with patience, and how the moment one experiences the maturity of consciousness, one must seize a spiritual perception with concepts so that it may be transmitted into the realm of human knowledge. The end of chapter 69. The last chapter, chapter 70. It will be difficult to separate what follows as an account of my life from the history of the anthroposophic movement. Nevertheless, I do not want to bring any more than is necessary of the society's history into this description. This will apply even to naming active members. My description is now near enough to the present time that to mention names could easily lead to misunderstandings. Despite all goodwill, some may become bitter on not finding themselves among those named. Essentially, I shall name only those who, apart from their activity within the society, have connections with our culture, whereas I will not name those who did not bring such connections with them to the society. Two quote-unquote opposites in anthroposophic activity developed in Berlin and Munich. Some came to anthroposophy to find the spiritual meaning that their souls longed for and had been unable to find in the scientific worldview or in traditional religion. In Berlin, the society branch members and the audiences at the public lectures consisted only of those who had rejected worldviews opposed to traditional religions. Those who adhered to worldviews based on rationalism, intellectualism, and so on, considered anthroposophy to be fantastic or superstitious. Thus we began to see public audiences and members who took up anthroposophy as their sole guide to a spiritual life. They were unsatisfied with what was offered from other sources. This soul mood had to be taken into account in the work. And because of this, the membership grew steadily, as did the size of the audiences at public lectures. An anthroposophic life emerged that was, in a sense, self-contained and virtually ignored any other endeavor toward spiritual insight. All hopes were directed toward what anthroposophy had to say. The expectation was that one could continually increase knowledge of the spiritual world. The situation in Munich was different. From the very beginning, an artistic element was active in the anthroposophic work. One could assimilate a worldview such as anthroposophy in a completely different way than one could rationalism and intellectualism. The artistic image is more spiritual than a rationalistic concept. It is alive and, unlike intellectualism, does not kill the spirit in the soul. Those in Munich who set the tone and built the membership and public audiences there were also the ones in whom the artistic feeling worked as mentioned. Consequently, right from the beginning, the society branch in Berlin was marked by uniformity. All who came to anthroposophy had the same sort of interests. In Munich, on the other hand, the artistic feelings evoked individual needs in individual groups. I gave lectures to those various groups. Gradually, a kind of core of those groups built up around Countess Pauline von Kalkreuth. They also gathered around Sophie Stinde, who died during the war. This group also arranged my public lectures in Munich. The continually deepening understanding of its members created a beautiful openness for what I had to say. I must say that the way anthroposophy developed in that group was very gratifying. Ludwig Deinhardt, the old theosophist and friend of Hübeschleiten, quickly became a very congenial and extremely valued member of the group. The center of another group was Frau von Schewitsch. She was a very interesting person, which no doubt contributed to the fact that a group gathered around her that was less interested in deepening anthroposophic knowledge than in associating with it as merely one spiritual stream among others of the time. Furthermore, Frau von Schewitsch had just published her book titled How I Found Myself. This was an exceptionally strong avowal of theosophy, and another reason she was an interesting center for this group. To me, as to many in the group, Helena von Schewitsch represented a significant piece of history. She was the object of a duel between Ferdinand LaSalle, who consequently met an early death, and a Romanian. Later she led a career as an actress. In America she became a friend of H.P. Blavatsky and Alcott. She was a woman of the world. At the time I gave lectures in her house, her interests had become strongly spiritual. Her powerful experiences gave extraordinary weight to her manner and speech. I could discern much through her about LaSalle and his time, and also many features of H.P. Blavatsky's life. She spoke subjectively and with the arbitrary color of fantasy, but, if one allowed for that, one could see through the disguises of truth. She was an altogether unusual person. Other groups in Munich were configured differently. I often recall a gentleman who frequented several of those groups, a Catholic cleric, who took a position outside of the narrow bonds of the church. His name was Müller, and he was a discerning expert on Jean Paul. He edited a very interesting periodical titled Renaissance, in which he defended a liberal Catholicism. He accepted as much of anthroposophy as he found interesting in his view, but always remained skeptical. He raised objections, but in such an amiable and elementary way that it often introduced a note of delightful humor into discussions after the lectures. By describing the anthroposophic work in Berlin and Munich as opposites, I do not intend to imply that one was better than the other. It was simply a diversity of human nature, all of it valuable in its own way, that became very prominent and required consideration in the work. In any case, there is no point in making a value judgment. Because of the way the work proceeded in Munich, the 1907 Theosophical Congress arranged by the German section took place there. The conferences, which were held previously in London, Amsterdam, and Paris, included arrangements for addressing problems related to theosophy in lectures and discussions. They were based on the same pattern as the scholarly conferences. They also dealt with administrative problems in the society. Many of the arrangements were modified for Munich. We, the organizers, provided a large concert hall to serve the conference, along with interior decoration, whose color and form would reflect artistically the dominant mood of the subject of oral deliberations. The artistic environment would become one with the spiritual activity there. In relation to this, I placed great value on allowing the artistic feeling to speak and to avoid abstract, inartistic symbolism. An artistic performance was included in the program. Charest's reconstruction of, titled The Sacred Drama of Eleusis, had been translated some time before by Marie von Sievers, and I had adapted it for performance. We included it in the program. Thus a connection, however slight, was established with the ancient mysteries. But the main thing was that the conference included artistic work. It pointed to the will never to allow spiritual life into the society without an artistic element. Marie von Sievers rendered the part of Demeter in a way that indicated the nuances dramatic art should attain in the society. Apart from this, through the inner power inherent in speech, Marie von Sievers had developed the art of declamation and recitation to a decisive stage, from which further progress could be made in this art. A great many of the older members of the Theosophical Society from England, France, and particularly from Holland were completely dissatisfied with the innovations offered at the Munich Congress. It would have been good if more people had understood that the anthroposophic attitude toward the spirit was entirely different from the one present so far in the Theosophical Society. This inner attitude is the real reason the Anthroposophical Society was unable to continue as a part of the Theosophical Society. Most people, however, believe that the main reason had to do with the absurdities that gradually developed within the Theosophical Society and led to endless bickering. That is, the life story of Rudolf Steiner ends here. He died March 30th, 1925. The end of the autobiography. Chapters in the Course of My Life, 1861 to 1907. The Collected Works of Rudolf Steiner, Volume 28.